I hope you'll find it useful for that sort of reason. Let me just maximize this. And also, it's very much based on my own research and my own work. So it's a obviously something I can present with more authority than second-hand stuff. So the topic I want to present now is what we call aging and financial instability. And you may think, well, what does aging have to do with financial instability? Basically, this was a paper I was invited to give at the Bundesbank a number of years ago, but which got updated at the Austrian National Bank. They got me to their conference in the mid-2000s. And basically, it's the long-term issue of aging, but trying to think about it in respect of financial crisis. And I think you'll find it quite intriguing. It's really going to at least make you think a bit more about demographics in economics, how demographic changes may influence the behavior of economic and financial variables. And I have done further work in that area for the Reserve Bank of Australia, had a conference every year, which is a nice one to go to, because you get a free trip to Sydney. And I went there a couple of years ago and did some broader work on the impact of demographic variables on things like saving, on current accounts, and stuff like that. So, and you really can get some good, sensible macroeconomic patterns looking at demographic shifts in the population. So what I'm going to do now, though, is to look in particular at the impact of aging on financial stability, and drawing on theoretical and empirical work, on the one hand on financial stability, which we've heard about, and also, though, on aging, which we haven't. So to that extent, it will be new to you from me. Maybe you've heard from others about it as well. And what I'm going to be focusing on, of course, as usual, is financial crisis and systemic risk, and how, as the population gets older, some of the risks might increase, some of the risks might change, and there may be an interesting pattern that we should watch out for the future. And the thing is that if there is a link from financial instability to aging, then something we might want to worry about is not just the normal thing, which is the changes at a macroeconomic level that affect everybody via consumption and investment and credit rationing, but that financial instability might, in some cases, affect retirement income security for individuals. And I know that in many new member states, there has been quite a turbulent time in retirement income since the end of communism, because the old pension systems have often been renewed. You've put in funded schemes. The value of the pensions was not always easy to maintain, etc., etc. So we'll talk about not just macroeconomic and banking sector effects of financial instability, but also impacts on retirement income security. So what we're going to do then is to firstly look at indicators, which we won't go into detail on because we've already done that. We'll look at the aging problem. We'll look at the effects of aging on the macroeconomy and pension systems, which I think is really interesting. We'll look at financial market effects of those impacts, in particular on saving. And then finally, we'll look at the effects that we might see on systemic risks. So it's a, how should we put it? It's a long-term thing, but as I think I'll mention as we go along, I would certainly argue that the Japanese banking crisis has some aging effects involved in it. For example, you'll remember I talked about the very high level of saving in Japan that households were putting into banks and that banks were then lending on into commercial property that then led to the banking crisis. Households thought they were doing that to keep their retirement income going, and because of, on the one hand, very rapid aging in Japan, which drove saving, but also uncertainty about the future of social security in Japan that was making for uncertainty. Indicators of financial instability we don't need to go through really. I've argued before, and I argue in this paper, we need a selective synthesis of the various theories, and that's something you've heard already on the first day, unless anyone wants to hear it again. And from those, again, as we've heard in this lecture course, we develop macroprudential indicators, in particular to do with regime shifts, entry conditions, debt and asset price booms, innovation, risk concentration, and lower capital adequacy. Those are the sort of broad generic indicators of financial instability that I've been discussing. And I would contend that those still hold in most financial crises, so they're pretty helpful. And econometric work, this is an older piece, so it doesn't take into account the latest stuff, but the various pieces of work that have highlighted the indicators that I mentioned yesterday again, credit growth, GDP, per capita, broad money to Forex, etc. The latest stuff is the one at the bottom, our work on bank capital, liquidity, and property prices. So, obviously that's part of this lecture in the sense that we need to have those things in mind if we're going to make some deductions from aging patterns in respect of likely risks. So we're going to keep an eye open for that. Okay, what is the aging problem? The aging problem is fairly well known. There's been a lot of work at the OECD on it, for example, that across most advanced countries and increasingly in emerging markets as well, we've got higher life expectancy, which is a really nice thing. So that's one thing, but accompanying that is the decline in the birth rate, which seems to occur when countries get better off. And the combination of those two factors has given rise to an aging population, because there are less young people around. There are more old people who were born in the days when there was a high birth rate, and that in turn, we shall see, gives rise to financial difficulties for countries that have generous, what we call pay-as-you-go pension systems. I'm sure you're all aware of the nature of pension systems, but just to remind you, pay-as-you-go, basically, the workers pay the pensioners directly. So the workers pay some kind of national insurance or pension credit, and rather than anything else happening, the money goes to the government and they use it to pay the pensioners. And funding the workers instead save in a fund, and that goes to their own future pensions, okay? That's just well known. And I think I had a discussion here which says that you've got elements of both, yeah, in this country? Yeah. And in particular, you've got what's called the defined contribution. They're both defined contribution, I think. Defined contribution, not just a pension system, a funded system, but a defined contribution pay-as-you-go, which is like Sweden and Italy, and seems like a very good idea. The point is, though, that in many Western European countries, and the US to some extent as well, the pay-as-you-go system is not defined contribution. The pay-as-you-go system is defined benefit. In other words, the benefits are already set out and somebody's going to have to pay for them. And we think especially of places like Germany, Italy and France, Spain, Greece, etc. Basically what they did was they made big promises to pay pensions to people back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and they then are facing this difficulty that suddenly there are more old people and less young people, and the whole equilibrium of a pay-as-you-go system depends on having more workers than pensioners in order to make the contribution rate not excessive, right? If you've got loads of pensioners and not many workers, then you end up with a crisis because the workers will be paying too high premia, or the employers will be paying too high employment taxes. And that's what these countries are facing. So let's have a look at some numbers. These are life expectancies at birth across the G7. And what you can see there is the general increase in life expectancy over the last three decades. And it's gone up to 80 or so. In Japan, people live for longer than everywhere else, probably because they eat more fish and less meat. Who's to know? But somehow the Japanese live longer than everybody else. But you can see just the general pattern of people living longer. And I'm sure that's true here too. And fertility rates, this is the number of children per woman of any kind, whether they get married or not, and whether they have children or not. So what this is showing is to what extent the population is renewing itself, and the rate needed for renewal is just a little bit over 2, usually, we think. And what you can see there is that in all of the G7, except the United States, the fertility rate has gone well below 2. And in particular, in Japan, Germany, and Italy, the fertility rate is extremely low. It's down at less than 1.5. In France, UK, it's somewhat higher. Obviously, that only goes up to 2000. I think there's been a little bit of a recovery in some countries, but I think the general pattern is still the right one. Except for the US, the Western OECD countries are not reproducing themselves. And as we probably know, a really interesting emerging market country that is facing similar patterns is China. Because in China, they have the one-child policy, and that insists that a family will only have one child, at least in the cities. And therefore, China is forcing its population to decelerate in much the same way as these countries. And in a sense, in the long run, that may be okay because you don't want a huge population that you can't provide food for, etc., etc. But in the transition to the low population, you get these demographic problems. And an indicator of the demographic problem is what we call the elderly dependency ratio. As it says, the elderly dependency ratio is the 65 pluses as a percentage of the 15 to 65s or 64s. So basically this is showing us the measure of the issue that I talked about. How much working population do we have relative to how many pensioners? If we assume that 65 is more or less the time when everyone will be in pension. And what you can see there is that back in 1960, the pattern was fairly stable and satisfactory in the sense that there were about 6 workers per pensioner, at least in most of these countries. 6 people of working age, that is, whether they were working or not. By 1990, it had gone down to about 5 or maybe 4, but the numbers in 2010 and 2030 are much more interesting, in the sense that here you're getting to 4 or 3, and here you're getting close to 2, in Italy especially. So what we're saying is that there will be only two workers in Italy by 2030 for every pensioner. In some other countries it'll be 3, but you can see all those countries are facing the same pattern of growing burden of elderly people. And, you know, you can immediately think, well, that doesn't have to be necessarily a huge burden, in the sense that maybe we can change the retirement age, and some countries are going to do that. They're going to force people to retire older, that will make this ratio go down a bit. But politically, it's not always easy to change your retirement income system. And so the issue is still likely to remain quite an acute one. And here are some projections that the OECD did on what the pay-as-you-go system would have to produce in order to support that pattern of elderly. And these are the numbers that really frighten people, because if you look at the current period, I mean, this was around early 2000s that this was these data were produced. You can see that the pay-as-you-go system is using up around 10% of GDP, which is still quite a lot. It's not, of course, a gross, it's transfer, right? So it means that you're raising 10% of GDP from somebody and giving 10% of GDP to somebody else. But still, 10% of GDP might be more or less sustainable. But if you look at the numbers out here, they're much worse, in that you've got 15% in Japan and France, and you've got 20% in Germany and Italy. So those countries have got a big aging problem. The Americans keep complaining about theirs, but it's much less severe than in continental Europe. And the UK, the pensions are so mean that it's not going to cost us much at all, but we'll have lots of poor pensioners. That's the big issue, that the fiscal issue that people are often concerned about. And maybe some of you will want to say what the issue, how does it look in this country, all that? Is it okay because you got rid of all the pension obligations?
No, it's not okay apart from this principle. The problem is that there is a rule which links pensions to past inflation,
yeah,
and revenues from social tax. But there were made one offer, increases in pension. Pension was raised a few times, and now it's inconsistent to,
yes,
future revenues. So the only option is just to reduce pensions, or principally it's also possible that you can increase retirement age, but it's not so influential.
But you probably don't want to raise the social tax. Although you could do that as well. Yes. Okay.
The European Commission has assessed our pension system the most sustainable.
Good, good. Yeah.
So I think we're resembling the UK.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's good. That's what I would expect, because in a sense this is like a legacy problem for Western European countries. In new member states, see, I'm careful not to say Eastern Europe now. New member states, mostly you've been able to start with a blank sheet, and that's good, because it's enabled you to hopefully avoid these problems. But in a sense, they're warnings in that case. Okay, now let's talk about macro developments, macro effects of aging, which I think are quite interesting, especially if you haven't thought about them before. We have to start by having in mind the production function. So You remember we had yesterday Q equals F of K and L? So that's our production function, where Q is output. I'll write it down. Obviously that's output, that's capital, and that's labor. Okay. So that's our economy-wide production function. And what is likely to happen to the macroeconomy as the population gets older and older? Well, the first point is that growth is likely to decelerate because there's lower labor supply. So the input to the capitals, to the economy from labor is less. That rates growth slow down. You may say, well, why don't firms invest more? They will to some extent in order to boost productivity, and therefore K might grow more, even though L is falling. But the argument is that that may not happen at a macro level because of diminishing returns and because of crowding out. So the growth of Q, the growth of output, is likely to fall. As we say, what we may be able to do to get L back up again is to get more people participating of a working age. We could raise the retirement age as well, although it has to be said in practice many people in England and other countries, I suspect as well, have already stopped working even when they get to the pension age, so it's not always straightforward. Possibility of higher productivity growth as well. Now, I'm not going to go through it here, but in the paper that I reference called Demographic and Pension System Challenges to Monetary and Financial Stability, as well as in another paper I did for a later Bundesbank conference, I found that aging hits productivity. Okay, so in other words, the older your workforce, the less likely they are to grow labor productivity. So, because maybe they're less flexible, various possible reasons. So that's not going to be easy, at least if the patterns continue to be like they have been in the past. And what is likely to happen to saving? Private saving is likely to decline because basically anyone over 65 is likely to be dis-saving. We think of the life cycle pattern of consumption and income. That's time, and that's consumption and income. If we start from, we're assuming we're starting from some sort of start of the working life, then we generally want to have a stable level of consumption. And meanwhile, our income is likely to follow a pattern something like this. Our income, in other words, is below our consumption when we start work, straight out of university. We may borrow to buy houses and stuff. When we're in middle age, hopefully our income is more than our consumption, so we can save. When we retire, our consumption is likely to be more than our income. That's when we're decumulating savings over lifetime, our pension assets, etc., etc. So, and you can find this in the macro very easily. In fact, I can show you if you want later. That there's a massive, there's a strong and very decisive demographic effect on saving, whereby the middle cohort, 40 to 64 boosts saving. The younger cohort is kind of neutral, maybe negative, but the older cohort, 65 plus, cuts saving very decisively. To some extent, pension reform may help, especially if we move to funding, which makes it more of an incentive to raise saving. But at a macro level, we're also likely to get falls in public saving as well. In other words, fiscal deficits, because of the need to finance the increasingly generous pay-as-you-go schemes. And, you know, that's what we're going to do unless we do the sorts of policies that he mentioned at the back, either cutting pensions, raising the retirement age, or raising contribution rates, which may be harmful to economic performance. And the system of retirement income provision, I've talked to you about pay-as-you-go versus funding, is likely to impact on growth and saving as well. Why is that? I think we can argue that pay-as-you-go, at least especially defined benefit pay-as-you-go, where your contributions are not directly related to your pension, may well reduce growth because it's distortionary. It means that you're making these contributions, that you're not necessarily going to be linked to your pension. This is why your model, what we call the defined contribution pay-as-you-go, is very good, because at least when you pay a contribution for your pension, you know that it will directly affect your pension. That's the idea of defined contribution pay-as-you-go. But most of them are defined benefit, and that means that labour supply is going to be affected. Labour demand might be affected as well if employers get fed up with the level of labour contributions they have to make, which is certainly true in countries like Germany, France, etc. On the other hand, if we have funding, and this is the World Bank recipe, Chile, etc., started it all, and I know that Estonia has got a funded pillar as well. Funding may boost growth if it improves resource allocation. You develop equity markets, you have price allocation of resources because of the signals from the equity market. You get more long-term funding for investment via bonds, etc., etc. So growth itself may be affected by those things, and some people have done research suggesting that you can detect those effects, and that's worth looking into. What about saving? Basically, you can distinguish between whether there's confidence in your pay-as-you-go system or not. And the classic pay-as-you-go system, the unfunded Social Security, is actually going to reduce saving, because if you just make these contributions and then you know you get your pension, so you don't really need to save in that case. On the other hand, if you lose confidence in this, you think, basically I'm paying my contribution, but when I become a pensioner I won't get much, which is, I think, the fear of the Japanese, then you start saving as a precaution. And that's... it's always hard to know exactly where the public is on that interface, but I think there's a decent amount of precautionary saving in countries like Germany and France, where people are not really sure whether they'll get their pensions or not. Meanwhile, a lot of research shows that if you switch to funding from pay-as-you-go, then that may well boost saving, because you know you're saving through the funded system. And that's the way that you're going to accumulate your pension. Now, there are various projections of saving, growth, and investment, particularly from the European Commission, also from the OECD. Basically, these are using global macro models. The suggestion is that there are certain patterns that are going to arise, and these are things we want to bear in mind when we think about financial stability and aging. I mean, bear in mind that's what we're building up to, yeah? That initially, for the next few years, saving might remain quite strong because we've got what's called the baby boomers. The baby boomers are the people who were born in the post-war period, up to about the mid-60s or even 1970, when there was lots of confidence in the economy and people had lots of babies. And those are the people who are now about to retire because they were born in the 50s or 40s. And they're in the high savings period at the moment. So we've got this big post-war cohort that's in this area here, And so that gives the initial rise in private saving. And as a compound of that, the OECD was expected, this is a bit before the China miracle, by the way, to have a balance of payments surplus and a deficit later. So obviously when your private saving falls off because everyone's retired, then you may well end up with a deficit because your macroeconomic saving investment balance is now shifted away from saving. And that gives you the external balance. Lower growth, as we said, because of less labor, lower public saving because of the fiscal problems, and flat or declining investment because of low economic growth. And the external imbalance depends in turn on the relationship between saving and investment. The argument is there could be initially a surplus for the EU, but later a deficit if EU countries save relatively more than their trading counterparts. And just some projections there from the OECD, quite an old one, was suggesting that growth would be really low in Europe, the US and Japan by 2030. And that's based on this production function, the idea that growth is basically going to slow down drastically because of the labour shortage. All OECD countries run external surpluses, they have to deficits. More recent one from the Commission had the US running a deficit, the EU and Japan a surplus. And clearly the US has run a deficit, despite the baby boomers, and the deficit, though, these should take one done nowadays, we'd have to think about China as well. And of course, as I said earlier, China is aging very rapidly, and China, if you like, is a kind of mega version of this thing over here, in the sense that Chinese people are doing lots of saving, partly because in China there isn't really much of a pension system for a lot of people, especially in the countryside. So this sort of life cycle saving, investment, saving and consumption pattern, and income pattern, helps us to understand why China is saving so much. It's also to do with the government, but I think a household sector explanation also helps. And a key issue is how absorptive the slow-aging emerging market economies were going to be. India, I guess, is the one to look at there. And India also has a strong capital and labour, also strong savings as well. So in the sense that they're running balance of payment surpluses, might be a counterpart to later deficits in the Western countries. Okay, so let's now think about financial market. We've talked about the macroeconomy and aging. What about the financial market effects of the savings patterns? Pay-as-you-go, it's argued, especially if confidence is lost, could boost precautionary saving in life insurance and bank deposits. Obviously, in a pure pay-as-you-go country, you don't have pension funds. So it's those other sectors that get boosted. And those are the sectors that grew a lot in Japan in the run-up to the banking crisis. And you would also expect more government bonds. And this is really interesting in this sense that we've had this financial crisis. We've messed up fiscal policy, and we're running the biggest deficits and the biggest growth in government debt in history. But the aging problem, which is the kind of elephant in the room that is really going to multiply that, is still on its way, okay? Really, if we were getting ready properly for the aging problem, we should be running fiscal surpluses and running down our government debt, ready to get the flexibility. So that's really worth thinking about, I think. Not for your country, perhaps, so much, but you are going to be in EMU with a lot of countries that are going to have this problem. a compounding of fiscal problems by the pensions on top of the mess that has been caused by the current recession and the financial crisis. What about funding? It generates an increased demand for securities. That can be proven, as well as also relative to deposits, and that's going to boost capital markets. As we said earlier, having a bond market is a good thing for the corporate sector because it enables them to switch out of bank loans out into bonds, so that's good for the corporate sector as well, in that sense, as well as just general capital supply. Funding is likely to generate gross capital flows, in other words, forgetting about just saying on balance there'll be funds flowing out, there may well be funds flowing back as well to emerging markets because of diversification. So you'll have growing pension funds, life insurers, mutual funds that are building up the pension assets, and capital flows will go out to those countries, to emerging markets, because it's a diversification benefit. Eventually the demand for securities will tend to decline, because even with funding, eventually you get lots of people who want to cash in their pension funds, and that will lead to a fall in demand. They'll have to cash in their securities, basically. And also we can predict eventually pensioners will want to, people saving by funding will want to switch from equities to bonds. The basic argument is that, supposing this is age 65, that's 20, that's 85, if you're here, then it makes a lot of sense to invest in equities, as I assume your personal funded pension schemes probably are, because you've got a long time horizon before retirement, and the average return on equity is higher than the average return on debt. On the other hand, as you get closer to 65, you don't like the volatility of equities so much, because you might suddenly get a crash just when you want to take your pension. So the what's called lifestyle investment says you start with big equity holdings and then later on you switch to bonds. If we think of that across the whole population, then there will be a switch from equities to bonds as the average population age moves to the right, even with a funded scheme. Okay, any questions or thoughts? Let's talk about some systemic risks then that might relate to the sorts of patterns we've talked about. And the first type of systemic risk relates to the overall macro development that I've mentioned. What we said was that if we have an initial rise in saving, which may relate to more people getting into the middle age group here, or maybe a shift from pay-as-you-go to funding, that would also boost saving, then that can, if not offset, generate currency appreciation and loss of competitiveness. And currencies go all over the place, but it is interesting that the yen, for example, has always been very strong and is particularly strong now. I don't say that we can attribute that directly to this, but there's a tendency for those currencies to appreciate just because of the high level of saving. And that, of course, is where the Chinese are trying desperately to hold their currency down, because otherwise the tendency with their big surplus and with the saving in excess of investment would be for the renminbi to rise. There may well be accompanied excess liquidity during that time, if we've got lots of saving, asset price volatility, and possible policy errors. So I see that as part of the background of the Japanese banking crisis, that due to the demographics and due to lack of confidence in the pay-as-you-go system, the Japanese then and the Japanese always have been very keen on saving, and that's fine as long as you've got something useful to invest it in. but you may end up with, as I call it, excess liquidity, and money may flow instead to commercial property, for example, as we talked about this morning, generating problems of investment that is not productive. Or if you're the Chinese, you may end up buying loads of US Treasury bonds and risking the Americans devaluing their currency or creating inflation that will then expropriate you. As you know, it's the Chinese foreign exchange reserve managers who are holding it rather than the pensioners, but at a macro level, it all washes out. So that's a consequence of a excess of saving over investment in China today. If we think that the macro will later generate a balance of payments deficit in most OECD countries because of the pensioners' dissaving, then we might get a currency crisis and exchange rate volatility during that period. And that may, of course, again, accompany banking crises if the banks are fragile. And the argument for all this, I argue, is underlining the need to promote growth in the EU, as well as slow-growing emerging markets, that what we want to do is somehow prevent this from generating low growth. And I guess one way of doing that, as we said earlier, is more participation in the labour force. It's a longer retirement age, an older retirement age, but it's also measures to generate research and development, because there's also an exponent on here which relates to the technical progress in the economy. The more technical progress we get, then the more Q we get out of any given K and L. But also I'm arguing the central bank should be vigilant during the overall process. And the thing with central banking is it's easy not to take note of these long, long, long run effects, because you think, well, is it really going to affect the current cycle? Is it going to affect my monetary policy decision at the moment? I think the argument I would make is it's part of the overall situation that if you neglect it, then you may miss out on something, and that may be having an effect that you don't detect. Okay, so those are some risks if we just think of the macro development generally. We can also consider risks in respect of the pay-as-you-go system. And we can start off with what I call the extreme case of no reform. Supposing, in other words, that we, in Germany, France, Italy, etc., they carry on with a really generous pay-as-you-go system and don't bother to reform it. Then one consequence of that is the precautionary saving due to uncertainty. People will still worry about whether they'll ever get their pensions. And if that precautionary saving goes to banks, it may lead to underpricing of risk in domestic credit. And that's what, of course, happened in the 1980s in Japan. They underpriced risk, they lent to commercial property, and it ended up with a crisis. But equally, the banks might lend internationally. The saving has to go somewhere, and that arguably is part of the reason for some of the crises we've seen internationally during the last 20 or 30 years. And I would highlight in particular the Asian crisis of 1997, which you might remember related to the countries of Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, and Korea growing very quickly. They ran balance of payments deficits, and the balance of payments deficits were in effect financed by lending from banks in other countries. And Klaus Tuori, this Finnish guy, and myself had a look at those data using the BIS international banking data, and we found that European banks and Japanese banks were the main source of lending to the Asian countries. So money was getting into Asian countries. They thought it wasn't very risky because it was going to banks. What they didn't realize was that banks were lending it on in foreign currency to corporations who then took massive currency risk. And so the Asian crisis of those four countries was linked to a failure of the currency pegs. The currencies collapsed in Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand and Korea. The corporate sector was suddenly faced with massive rises in the value of its debt because it was in foreign currency, and they defaulted on their debts to the banks in those countries. The banks then defaulted on their debt to the Western banks, who made big losses. So you have to think this through in a global sort of way to say, well, saving has to go somewhere. If there's more saving in our economy than there is investment, it's got to be going somewhere. In China at the moment, it's going to US Treasury bonds. But in the past, a lot of saving has gone to international interbank markets. And in the run-up to the subprime crisis, we saw balance payments deficits in the US, in the UK, in Spain, I guess, as well, surpluses elsewhere. The wholesale funding on balance had to be coming from the surplus countries. So that's banks. Life insurers could invest in high-risk bonds, high-yield bonds, property as well, and would be vulnerable to the credit cycle. But the big difference between insurance companies and banks, of course, as we talked about earlier, is that insurance companies don't have maturity mismatch to the same extent. They are more protected against liquidity risk. So what we're more likely to be talking about here is just losses to policyholders. In the bank's case, if they make losses on the underpriced risk that they've been making, you could get a banking crisis. So that's saying we have pay-as-you-go, it's very generous. People start to worry and they save, and the saving gets misdirected. What about tax finance? This is the one you wanted to avoid, where you have to keep raising taxes on labor in order to pay for the pensioners, okay? So in Italy, we've got to raise 20% of GDP in labor taxes, only for pensions, let alone everything else, according to those numbers. And what one could envisage in that case, we've always got our hat on of macroprudential surveillors, right, is big economic difficulties generating credit losses and falls in asset prices, because high tax rates are not really consistent with economic growth. They're going to hit Q that way. And that would be very difficult to accurately anticipate. And the worst scenario you could imagine is what I call factor flight, whereby both young workers as well as factories and entrepreneurs decide they're not staying here anymore. They're not staying in Italy or Greece or Germany anymore. They're going to move to India or wherever it is. That's the entrepreneurs. I guess the workers might move to, I don't know where they'll move to, somewhere else in the EU. They might move to Estonia, how about that? Nice stable country. And if you look at what one thing that worries me a lot, if you look at the EU, is definitely the southern European countries, which as we know can't control their inflation, but also can't control their fiscal problems either. And one has to ask whether the negative effects that's having on economic growth will lead to this sort of factor flight eventually. Okay, there is another way, which we didn't mention earlier, of dealing with a pay-as-you-go system, which is bond finance. So supposing instead of raising taxes to pay for the pensions, the government just issues lots of debt, runs a deficit, issues bonds. And of course, in the long term, bond finance is the same as tax finance, because the bonds are going to have to be paid back. But in the case of bond finance, we might envisage a sharp rise in long-term interest rates, loss of credit rating, which in turn leads to crowding out and a recession. And again, this is very topical if we think about the possibility of a downgrade in Greece that might in turn have a rise in its euro bond yield and have an effect on the domestic economy. But we can think about that in the long term if countries are silly enough to not reform their pay-as-you-go system. If that actually happened, we had high long-term rates, we would have credit losses for lenders. One thing worth noting is that most past fiscal crises were with unliberalized banking systems. So, you know, we've seen countries run into the buffers before with the fiscal policy, but often they were able to, the banking systems weren't hit so much because they weren't lending very much at not very high risk. So whatever interest rate rises there were didn't affect the banks much. And the other thing that I don't mention there is that in the past people were quite willing to go into inflation to get rid of fiscal problems. But inflation doesn't get rid of this. Inflation gets rid of fiscal debt, but inflation does not get rid of a pay-as-you-go pension system. Because what happens, as long as you don't de-index the pensioners and reduce their real pensions, then you end up with higher pensions and the workers have to pay higher contributions. So inflation doesn't save you unless you risk the political problem of de-indexing pensioners. And let me just say one thing, that Estonia is particularly smart for having got all this sorted out, hopefully, already, because you try introducing a radical pension reform that cuts pensions when there is 50% of the 30% of the population is over 65 and the rest of them are almost 65 already. Can you see that the political difficulty of reforming pension systems gets much harder the longer you leave it, because people are aged and turkeys don't vote for Christmas, right? You know that expression, turkeys don't vote for Christmas? So they're unlikely to support a radical pension reform, whereas in your country, so long as you can hold it, the early pension reform, when the aging is not so bad, is quite a good thing. But as I say, you should still listen, because you've got to live with these countries in EMU. Okay, government's ability to recapitalize banks declines. If the government is up to its neck in fiscal debt because of aging, then it won't be able to cope with the banking crisis very readily. And ultimately, we could have a fiscal solvency crisis. The way that you get a fiscal solvency crisis, you may remember, is that you have the debt rising faster than the interest burden driving the debt higher. That's the tipping point when a fiscal problem becomes unsustainable. And that was what we had to investigate very carefully. I won't comment on the outcome when we were doing the convergence report for EMU back in 1998. There will be snowballing temptation to monetize, but as I say, monetization doesn't get rid of the pensions problem. And in EMU, spillovers to countries that have reformed, that's something that they won't be particularly happy with, to say the least. Okay, a third kind of systemic risk to think about as we get aging is linked to institutional investors. And what we're talking about here is not so much a worsening of total systemic risk as a change in its direction, and therefore a need for us to be flexible in how we think about it. And I start off with these points, that if we have a big institutional investor sector, by which we mean pension fund, life insurance, mutual funds, there should actually be a fairly stabilizing note because of the following. Compared with a system with lots of banks, we have more accurate asset pricing, we should have more liquidity because of the trading by the institutions. We should have transparency and marking to market, although as we know, marking to market is not always an easy thing. Institutional investors are further from the safety net. They don't tend to get rescued, so they should have less moral hazard. And they also generate, what I said earlier, multiple avenues of intermediation, whereby if there are bond markets, corporations have alternative sources of funds. On the other hand, I would argue there are risks in the transition that may require close vigilance. For one thing, as you shift from bank intermediation to institutional intermediation, that disintermediates the banks. They get less deposits, they have less loan demand, which may be balanced, it may not. If banks are disintermediated more on the loan side than on the deposit side, then you have the Japanese pattern, you take risks to keep your profitability. The institutional investors are serving all the good customers, you need to stay profitable, you raise your risk profile. And that may be true especially if there's low profitability and excess capacity anyway. So these are risks, right, with institutional investor growth where we've got funding. Funding doesn't take every problem away. And we also have the unfamiliar risks, although they're familiar to you because I've talked to you about them. The crises numbers 2 and 3. Number one, remember, was the banking crisis. Number two is extreme price volatility after a shift in expectations. And I would add asset allocation. So the sort of volatility that we saw in the stock market crash, the ERM crisis as well, and various other times of volatility have often related to shifts by institutional investors in their asset allocation from equities to bonds, from certain country equity to other country equity, etc. And that can hit the banks that are in those in the line of fire, so to speak. And the other is protracted collapse of market liquidity and issuance after similar portfolio shifts. And there we remember Russia LTCM. What did that cause? It led institutional investors to switch from higher risk debt, like emerging markets, like corporate bonds, into government bonds. And that shift in portfolio allocation by the institutional investors, as well as by the investment banks, caused the market liquidity crisis of any lower yielding instrument. And we've equally seen hedge funds do that in the recent crisis as well, of course. But we're just saying, what are the risks in an institutionalized financial system? And we're saying the risks don't go away, but they get to be a different kind. So during these periods of turbulence, we would argue there are threats to emerging markets, who may be the destination of the investment, threats to banks, who may be holding leverage positions, and also the non-financial sector. And equally, institutional investors themselves could be vulnerable to credit risk in real estate. And they've also proven, of course, to be vulnerable to underfunding, those that are defined benefit, due to falling equity prices. But that's not a systemic risk. It's just a problem for them. Okay, systemic risk number 4, and I think this one is the most interesting. Is linked to asset accumulation. And what we can look back on, and the asset pricing, basically. What we can look back on in the 90s is that people like Schiller argued that the reason why there was the dot-com boom was partly because people were increasingly putting money into mutual funds and into pension funds, and that was a sheer supply effect, a sheer demand effect on the equity market. That equity prices were driven up during the dot-com boom by the demand for mutual funds. And of course that linked also to expectations, but it may have generated excessive optimism that led to overvaluation of shares by the time we got to 2000. And as you know, after that time, the equity market collapsed by 50% or more in 2000 to 2002. So it's those sort of patterns that we are thinking about as we reflect on aging and asset accumulation in funding. So there could be bubbles in equity markets because you've got lots of saving via funded pension schemes, lots of people in here. We might also get bubbles in debt markets and in property, people pushing money into debt and reducing spreads, people reducing yields, raising prices on commercial property. And in that context as well, emerging markets could be seen as vulnerable to destabilization as institutional investors put money into them, they withdraw, etc., etc. That's a sort of Latin America type problem in the past, certainly. So that's the fact that rising saving via pension funds, etc., can cause bubbles. But equally, we can argue that as aging proceeds and we get into the decumulation phase over here, we could get falls in asset prices that could be systemically problematic. And why do we think that asset prices will fall as we get an aging population? Well, the first one is if we think of the simple determination of equity yields, equity prices, the equity price in the end depends on growth of dividends. And growth of dividends depends on future profitability and future returns. If we get a slowing of economic growth, and we may actually get lower real returns on capital. Obviously that depends on whether less labor drives up the return on capital or whether it leaves it the same. But clearly a lower economic growth may reduce the return on capital. The other point is that we may get lower save, so that's the sort of fundamental side of the equity market suggests an asset price fall. This one is the demand side, lower boot saving due to the baby bust. The baby boomers have retired. All we're left with are the small generations like yourselves, and they're not sufficient to hold up the equity market at a global level. And that lower saving might not just affect equity prices, it might also affect real interest rates or the risk premium. And the switch from equities to bonds as well that we talked about, as pensioners get close to their retirement, they're risk averse, could also affect asset prices in the long run. And I've got a bit of econometrics here that may be helpful. This was done with one of my students. We were looking at determination of share prices and determination of bond yields using macro but also demographic variables. So I hope I can remember all this. The most interesting variables are the first two. So age 20 and age 40 are cohorts. So age 20 is 20 to 39s over pop, and age 40 is 40 to 64s over pop. Okay. And DYHP is growth of output set up by a Hodrick-Prescott filter. So this is like trend growth. DGIFY is the remainder of economic growth when you've done a Hodrick-Prescott filter. So that's the sort of excess growth at any particular time. RLR is real long rate. Vol is equity market volatility. DY minus one is the lag dividend yield. So the idea here is, you know, it's not easy to model share prices, but it's to try and capture a number of useful variables that might help us to determine them. And you can see the real long rate, volatility, and the dividend yield have an interesting pattern. But the really important one is age 40. Age 40 basically boosts the growth rate of share prices in the United States, meaning that this pattern is reproduced in the asset prices and not just the saving. On the right hand side, you can see a bond market equation, and what this is saying is that the age 40 age group reduces the real bond yield. So in other words, and that's equivalent to driving up the bond price. So whereas the age 20 age group incidentally raises the bond yield, which may well be linked to house purchase of people of that age, which increases the demand for long-term finance. And this is based on that 1960 to 2003, I think. We also have a separate equation, which I'm not showing you here, which has the age 65 variable. And the age 65 variable is 65 plus overpopulation. And, yeah, I haven't put that below. So these are the projections that you can run on equity prices and bond yields. And what you can see then is that it was showing that because the baby boomers weren't retiring yet, the underlying pressure on share prices was to increase for a while before falling back, but still not falling very much, not falling below where they've been in the past. And the pattern for bond yields was that it was pretty constant, the expected real bond yield. I mean, this is just a rough exercise based on some assumptions about all the other right-hand side variables. But the really interesting one is when we include the age 65 variable, and this is the sort of doom machine that we may get, because then we get the initial boom, but then because the pensioners are selling their equities, we get a long-run downward effect on share prices. And possibly even more worrying, we get a long-run upward pressure on real interest rates in the long run, which is just what we don't want. You know, it's only partial, so it's just an indicator. But what it's saying is that you can actually detect some quite interesting demographic effects on asset prices that central banks may want to be concerned about. And the one interesting question, of course, is, well, has this already happened? Was this the dot-com boom because people expected this to happen? The fact that they're rising so much now, well, who knows? And, of course, the monetary authorities can do things about this. They can ease monetary policy, which may help. So they may not happen like this, but it's still worth thinking about. So if we think about macroprudential indicators and things that we ought to be looking at, I'm arguing that we should be keeping a close eye on public finances in particular, because not just because of the short-run fiscal situation, the effect on long rates, but also because of the relationship with pay-as-you-go. So fiscal situations warranted to be looked at, not just from monetary stability, but also financial stability. Secondly, financial instability will be more driven by institutional investor behavior than that of banks. Banks will be smaller. There may be risks in that transition to smaller banks, but institutional investors will have to be looked at very closely. But I think many of the theories and indicators will still remain relevant, although we may have to reinterpret them. So you'll remember the various theories we talked about right back in the first lecture. We may need to think about some of these issues again. The agency costs we talked about were relating then to bankers' behavior, behavior relative to their equity owners, behavior of banks relative to deposit insurance and the safety net, borrowers' behavior relative to banks, etc. In an institutionalized financial system, an important agency problem is that the investor or even the owner of the pension fund cannot always control the manager of the assets who's investing the assets on their behalf. So that's an important agency problem, that they may take excessive risk, and you need to be aware of that. The second one, we talk about uncertainty in the paradigms, uncertainty about the impact of aging on the economy and on financial flows. So that's something, again, to be aware of. We all estimate macro models without any of this demographic stuff in them, but they may be quite relevant. The third one is disaster myopia, about effects of aging. People don't see the problem coming. And of course, that applies not just to financial markets, but also to pension reform, if countries don't see the problem soon enough. We talk about herding already in the existing theories. Herding by institutional investors may have an important role to play in the future financial crises. We've already seen herding in the context of Russia LTCM, for example, and the 87 stock market crash. And an interesting thing about the subprime crisis is that the institutional investors seem to actually have been quite smart, because they avoided holding the CDOs that, in a sense, were actually designed for them. You know, securitization is supposed to spread risk to those best able to hold it, yeah? But what happened to the CDOs and ABSs? They actually got held by the banks, either themselves from other banks or in their own subsidiaries. And a possible reason for that is that institutional investors have started to be regulated according to mark-to-market, and they're actually a lot more cautious about what they hold as a consequence. Whereas banks, because of Basel, etc., had reasons to hold this stuff. So something went wrong. In a sense, we should have had a problem for institutional investors in 2007 and 8, because clearly the CDOs were going to turn toxic on somebody, but they actually turned toxic on the banks rather than the ones that they should have been holding them, namely the insurance companies and pension funds. You may say, well, what about AIG? But AIG, the American insurance company that went bust, that was because of derivatives contracts, I think, not necessarily because of bad assets. So herding, but also, and that may also link, of course, to the fact that institutional investors knew that they couldn't get rescued in the same way that banks could. And finally, industrial competition among asset managers will be important as well in thinking about theory. What about indicators? We will maybe have to think about stuff like the size and composition of retirement savings flows. Where are retirement savings going? Is it all going through pension funds, or are people pushing money into banks for some reason? If it is going into banks, is it generating liquidity risk or not? So that's important. Secondly, the fiscal policy issue, that it's debt accumulation by governments and its side effects come to the fore. We talk mainly in macroprudential surveillance about private debt, because that's what affects the banks most directly. But when we see these fiscal problems that are already happening and may worsen in the future, then who knows, we could have a government default for one thing, on assets that are held by banks, or at least effects on long-term interest rates from fiscal laxity. We talk about regime shifts. That may include small changes in institutional investor regulation, their accounting, the stress tests. One thing that was of interest during the dot-com bust in 2000 to 2003 was that life insurance regulation in the UK insisted that they would continually stress test their assets to make sure that they were not vulnerable to falling below some level. And the problem was that the only way to get the stress test to work was to get rid of equities. But when they got rid of equities, that generated lower equity prices and meant the stress test again required them to sell more equities. So the stress test was itself generating cumulative asset price falls, and the regulator realized that, and eventually they stopped imposing the stress test. But, you know, that was supposed to be a sensible stress test at a micro level, but at a macro level, when all the life insurers together were imposing it on themselves and saying, gosh, we'd better sell equities, then they ended up creating more of a price fall than would maybe have been the case. And exchange rate effects on the economy driven by savings flows, that you get an over-appreciation of the currency due to savings exceeding investment, for example, which might make your industry uncompetitive, or the opposite when you're in the phase of running a deficit. So we conclude. I'm arguing that the process of aging is likely to generate major shifts in financing and may lead to financial turbulence. And I'm arguing that risks arising from pay-as-you-go are much more serious. So a country with a pay-as-you-go scheme, to my mind, has got the worst problems in the future. And they're not just fiscal problems, they're problems that can affect the financial system as well. On the other hand, the risks due to funding mean that the central bank and the regulator has to adapt to institutionalization, which is a pattern that's happening anyway. And I'm arguing that the economy should be more robust with funding to withstand turbulence. So the policy issues include, we need to all reform unsustainable pay-as-you-go. So when you get into EMU, you've got to go on at the Germans, the French, the Italians to sort out their pay-as-you-go system so it doesn't damage the euro-wide bond market, when you have some bonds outstanding, that is. But, you know, these are contagious things, and I think the context of EMU is particularly interesting for financial stability and these sort of macro financial issues generally, because, you know, EMU is not a country, but it is a country, if you like. EMU is something where people are stuck together in terms of their financial markets completely, even though they have separate fiscal authorities. So the degree of contagion within EMU from whatever mistakes are made in individual countries is much greater than it is between countries where there are separate currencies. So that's an important reason why it's rational for governments to get on at each other. And I think it's very worrying that in EMU, the Stability and Growth Pact seems to have fallen by the wayside, because the French and the Germans can't manage to keep a 3% government deficit. You know, for the long term, that's not brilliant for fiscal policy within EMU at all. We need appropriate regulation of funding and investment for institutional investors, what we call the prudent person rule. In other words, that you shouldn't be obliged to hold a certain percentage of assets, but rather you should diversify sensibly and have international investment. And that banks and the regulators need to be vigilant for any side effects of aging. So does anyone want to make any comment?
I have a question.
Yeah.
You have listed three policy recommendations here. Don't you want to have another one, which would be increasing the retirement age?
Sure. That's part of the reform of unsustainable pay as you go.
Okay.
But yeah. Yeah. Certainly. What is the value of the pay as you go pensions here? Is it several percent of GDP already? Do you know? Does anyone know? The funded pensions, rather. You know, I meant the asset accumulation from your Pillar 3 or Pillar 2, whatever you call it. The little funds, what does that amount to now? Is it quite a lot or not so much yet?
Negligible.
Still negligible.
We never had the rich pensioners, and presumably we would have in the future too.
Yeah, but you're all contributing to this, aren't you?
Yes,
we just started a couple of years.
Okay, so it hasn't really built up yet. Okay.
We lost. No,
it's around the border.
Yes.
Yeah, 3% is much.
1-2%.
It's what, sorry?
1 or 2%
is something. 2% of your salary, sort of thing, is it? Or?
Two what?
Oh, 2% of GDP. Okay, yeah. So it's not exactly overwhelming the economy yet. it's allowed to invest internationally, I presume, is it? Or has it got to invest in Estonia?
Internationally.
Yes, that would make more sense, obviously. I understand from what you told me that pay-as-you-go is quite controlled, yeah? So, your situation is not so worrying, although I assume that in this country the birth rate is quite low, isn't it? So, yeah? One and a half, maybe? What do you think?
1.7, wasn't it?
1.7.
It's not so bad anymore. Yeah.
Okay.
But it's also somehow because of one baby boom and then.
Right.
But actually, maybe one policy issue to include is maybe that birth policy.
Is what, sorry? Yeah, yeah.
That, maybe there should be some influences for people to have more children. Or maybe. higher productivity.
Yeah, that's always the difficulty, isn't it?
No, the idea is that higher productivity people should have more children, then their children have higher productivity. And in that production function, then productivity will go up.
So yes, because
in
France, the third child is supposed to be the godfather is the president, they say, because you get huge benefits from having more than two children, and in France that kind of seems to work. Their birth rate is higher. They've always wanted a higher birth rate than the Germans ever since the mid 19th century, and. They seem to have succeeded for the moment. You were going to say something?
Well, I have a question, but I don't know where should I post it, but it's a little bit off the topic.
Yeah, okay.
And maybe recently there has been a discussion about adopting the models from ecology in finance.
Yeah.
And what do you think about those? Because I mean, Bank of England has been one of those which has been trying to make those, and also one of the names is not in terms of ecology models, but assembling or putting together behavioral finance, like Andrew Lord and the adaptive market hypothesis.
Well, certainly behavioral finance, I think, has got a big role to play because it underlies the disaster myopia hypothesis. I think we can see the disaster myopia definitely occurring. And indeed, with other guys at the fund, I've written a paper on East Asia and pro-cyclicality, and we found that people forget about banking crises the longer ago they are, which is in line with that. But I have to admit, I haven't looked in detail at the ecology models, but it's always worth investigating these things to see if they're helpful. I suppose it depends on whether one takes a psychological or a sort of evolutionary approach, or, you know, are human beings somehow different from animals or not? That's an interesting question.
All those predictions are made on the assumption, no change in behavior assumption, but in 20 years there can be so many changes in fact that
there's something in that, although, you know, we say that, but if we estimate macroeconomic relationships, sometimes they change, but not always hugely. But yeah, that's something you have to watch out for, definitely, regime shifts and behavioural changes, I agree. Okay, should we have a break? Start again at 3-ish.